It's 5 years to get him here, but I know that all of us are here. Thank you for that, Stephen.
Hello. My name's Jim, I'm an edit. Excuse the silences sometimes because my brain, I've got a great deal of knowledge, but my retrieval systems are a little bit slow. I think it's just my age. Let me just get used to talking into the microphone. It's quite a strange experience, but I was asked to do this chair, and my first thought was, can you wait until I'm well, though? Because, I mean, I'm asked to speak about my experience, strength and hope, but my immediate thought is I'm not well yet. Come back when I'm well. You know, can you just give me another year or another couple of years, and then I may be able to say something useful to someone. Because, you know, inside I am an addict. You know, I suffer from a disease which is ongoing. It's been arrested, and recovery is then possible. I know that. I don't always feel in recovery. I have to make a conscious effort to remind myself I am in recovery. I am recovering. I am getting better. You know, I have a voice. I am worth it. You know, my internal dialogue. It is not always like that. Just before the meeting started, I was lucky enough to walk across Trafalgar Square. Now, I live in London, I've lived in London all my life, and as I walked across the square, I just thought about, I don't know, I just felt really calm, really serene, you know, really a moment of peace. And I thought about back in the 60s, I was chased across Trafalgar Square by the drugs from West End Central. And I thought about, in front of the, I don't know if it's still the South African Embassy, but in the 60s and the 70s, there was a continuous protest out there. There was a picket going on for a bunch of people called AA, which is anti-apartheid. And often on a Friday night, I'd take part in that picket. I don't know why, it just was... I've always been a political kind of animal. Now, I'm aware I'm speaking as an addict tonight, so what I'm trying to speak about is just my experience with my addiction. But I also have a life as a person. You know, I am an addict, and addiction has, I don't know if the right word is damaged, but addiction has been, has clouded my life, shall we say. Yeah. Anyway, I remember as I was walking across the square, I remember, you know, sort of being on the pavement outside there, and it was quite a hostile scenario in the 60s and 70s. You know, there was, you know, terrific oppression going on in the world, and I was quite an idealistic person and thought it would make a difference if I, just one person, stood on the pavement. I also, the National Gallery's in the square as well, and I, throughout my recovery, I've gone into the National Gallery, and there's a painting on the wall by a guy called Rosa, who lived in the 18th century in Spain. And it's just a picture of this guy. He's just staring out of the canvas at you. And he's holding a marble, looks like a tombstone. He's just sort of leaning on this tombstone, looking right at you. And it's one of those pictures that if you stand anywhere in the room, the eyes follow you around the room. And I've seen this picture for 20, 30 years. And when I need a bit of peace, I just go in the National Gallery and stand in front of this picture for 10-20 minutes and just stare at him. And on this stone, he's got carved in Latin, "Be silent unless what you have to say is more important than silence." And it just reminds me that I can talk and say nothing. You know, I love chattering, gossip, waffle, you know, whatever you want to call it. I suppose my history around drug use was the uppers. That's my favourite kind of drug. You know, well, it was my favourite drug. Careful, I'm in recovery now. I don't do drugs, but if I just want to briefly say, I don't want to do a war story. I want to talk about my recovery and what it's like, you know, now. But you know, it's important for me to, you know, remember where I come from and remember what happened to me when I walked into, you know, how I came here. You know, very briefly, I was brought up in the 60s or the 50s, really, the 50s and the 60s. Things happened to me when I was a child and when I was a teenager. In 1967, I was going to be a Catholic priest. Sounds quite strange to say that. But I'd spent 4 years of my life studying towards becoming a priest, which is quite a serious commitment. It means you go and you live in a seminary for 7 years, with only men, studying Bibles and tracts and stuff like this. And I come from an Irish family. Irish mother's dream is to have one of your sons as a priest. And that was my lot. So there's no lot to do about it. It was just decided at some stage when I was a kid, you know, like, Jimmy's going to be the priest. And I went along with that. I thought, okay, I'm going to be the priest. Okay. Now, it's quite easy to going to be a priest when you're about 12, you know, before puberty, before you're kind of fully conscious of what's happening and things. But when I was 16, I realised with a vengeance that the last thing in the world I was capable of being was a priest. So I went into a state of perpetual revolt, I suppose it's quite a good word for it. And coincidentally, about the same time, I discovered that if you took drugs, that they were in a revolution, as I thought they were, you know. And I took a lot of drugs for a long time from that point. I got involved with quite a lot of political stuff. I was deported from France for setting fire to cars. I was basically my dream was to be a revolutionary, you know. I swallowed all that 60s counterculture stuff, lock, stock and barrel, the whole caboodle, you know, and I was living proof of that sort of 60s saying, tune in, turn on, drop out. That's what I wanted to do. My whole life was dedicated to doing that. And there were drugs around and there were people around and it was kind of cool to do drugs around that time. It wasn't, you know, it was just a way of life. What happened was in our readings it says, you know, like if you use drugs, there's only sort of three endings: jails, institutions and death. And over the next, you know, over my 20s, I discovered jails, I discovered institutions, I discovered near death. And I've had experiences of death, and it's hard to tell whether it's reality or not, you know, because it's difficult to know what is the truth and what is just my memory of the truth, sort of thing. But I can remember vividly being dead and being somewhere and somebody saying, "We don't want you yet. You've got an appointment, but it's not today. Go away. Go and wake up." And I would wake up somewhere, you know, I'd just become conscious. I didn't think about stopping using drugs then. My whole life was dedicated to just using drugs. And my favourite... and I used drugs for oblivion. It didn't start out like that, but it certainly ended up like that. And in 1979, I was walking dead, I suppose, or dead man walking, whatever. And at that time, my life was saved. My life was saved by a Christian guy, a guy called Michael Serbienda, who was a drug worker at St Thomas's Hospital. And I was a registered drug addict at the time. And Michael knew that I was dying. And he just helped me. He helped me by sending me to a rehab out in the country. I mean, rehabs had just started. So instead of just doing a detox and carrying on using, I suddenly found myself in hospital in Oxfordshire. I was clean. And then I was going up to this rehab house every day. They wouldn't let me in the house because I was too ill. So I would go along to the rehab during the day, treatment centre, whatever you want to call it. And I discovered that I quite enjoyed not using drugs. I quite enjoyed being clean. I enjoyed being physically fit. I quite liked eating. You know, I quite liked... I just liked, you know, fresh air, I suppose. You know, I liked listening to music and just life. You know, I was really grateful to not be dead. I stayed at that place and I was there 18 months, and it was a what they call a concept-based house, and I learned a lot about stuff, Gestalt stuff, and just deep therapy, basically, emotional groups, encounter groups, 24-hour groups, shaving your head groups, wearing a placard around your neck groups, and cleaning the kitchen with a toothbrush groups, and it was great. I loved it. Oh, I really loved that whole. It was a madhouse, but I loved it, and I was so anti-drugs, just so viciously anti-drugs. If anyone came in and even, I remember somebody came in one day and they listened to the Rolling Stones' Sister Morphine on the record player, and I went in the front room and caught them playing it. I went ballistic at them. You know, how can you do that? That's negative. That's whatever it was. You know, and really strange. I became a strange person. I think I was just determined to. I mean, looking back, I was just determined to be clean, but I didn't know what it was, and I was very frightened of using drugs again because. I knew if I used, I'd be dead, and I didn't want that. I left that place eventually, and I'd allowed myself a get-out clause. That if someone came along and offered me pharmaceutical drugs, clean works, and no chance of getting caught, then I would do it, because it would be God's will. And sure enough, someone came along with some, you know, some Diaconal, and you know, the rest is sort of history. But what happened was, from 1980 until 1993, I knew it was possible to be clean. I knew it was possible to have a life without drugs. I just did not know how to do it. I really thought that it would be okay to have just drink now. You know, just have a drink, that'd be okay. Just have a puff and a drink, it never was okay. I'd always end up picking up Class A drugs or getting some chaos, and it did my head in much more than it had ever done in my life before, because I kind of knew the... I never went back to using, you know, like I did prior to treatment, but I also knew that I was caught up in it, and it was horrendous, because it was inner death. I just, you know, I had no idealistic dreams or anything anymore. You know, I was just very sad, very lonely, very frightened, and just waiting to die, but not having the courage to kill myself. A real, you know, failure, like walking down the street with a big balloon over your head, failure, you know. And I mean, I ended up on the King's Road, just sat on the pavement in a pool of urine, drinking cans, looking at people going past me, but unable to beg because I couldn't talk. I was just a mess, a real physical, you know, emotional wreck. Thankfully, I by a miracle, I managed to get into a detox again, you know, and kind of come to with the white coats around me and, you know, detoxing again. And for some reason, I just thought I'd had enough. I really didn't want to carry on with that life. You know, I just thought there must be something more to life. You know, this can't be it. You know, I am worth so much more. You know, and from that point, I went into treatment again, but this was a very different experience. It wasn't fun. It was just, oh my God, I'm back in treatment again with all these crazies again. Oh no, you know, and I didn't like the people I was in treatment with. I didn't like the workers. I didn't believe anything anyone was telling me. And I was quite wise not to do that, because people in the house were using. Staff didn't have a clue what addiction was about. I just felt really lost. Anyway, I went to a meeting. I went to an NA meeting, and that's a strange, you know, that's a whole chair about how I got to the meeting. But basically, I got up because someone I don't know put a poster up in the rehab saying Narcotics Anonymous, do you want help? Ring this number. I rang the number, and there was someone at the end of the phone who told me there is a meeting, you need to go to this meeting. I went to the meeting in Victoria, I walked into an NA meeting, and I knew inside that this was it. I was in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, I was with other people who had used drugs like I had, who weren't using drugs, and I just knew that I really want some of this. I want it. I mean, I haven't used since, and then people kept rabbing on about, what's your clean time, what are you on about, you know. But I eventually worked out that the last day I used was the 31st of October 1993. What I very soon felt though, and I carried on going back to that meeting, and then I found out there were other meetings, and I carried on going out to these other meetings. I just felt lifted. I just felt, you know, my something inside me, you know, spiritually, I just felt, this is it. I just knew, the deep feeling inside, I can't explain it to anyone, you know, I think you either get it or you don't, you know, and I mean, I'm very lucky that I just knew that this was what I'd kind of been looking for. I was meant to be here, that sort of feeling. And then I heard that the way to stop using drugs is to stop picking up. So simple. I had just never thought of it before. And I couldn't believe that I just spent 14 years trying to get the magic answer. And the magic answer was stop picking up and you will stay clean. So simple. I think my brain was beyond simple, though. You know, I haven't got a simple brain. Like I said, I'm full of conspiracy theories, and you know, my brain is full of visions of you know, the Americans bombing Vietnam, and, you know, sort of Che Guevara and Jimi Hendrix and God knows what old rubbish is in my head, you know. It's just a really, I haven't got a clear, simple head. You know, my head's like walking into another country. You know, it's vast inside my head. You know, there's an NA saying, don't go in your head alone because it's a bad neighbourhood. I like that one because, you know, I feel that. You know, it's, I'm blessed to be here now and to be able to talk, you know, and if I just go back briefly to, you know, where I started walking across the folks who are on my way at this meeting, I just felt so glad that I had somewhere to come to tonight, you know, bringing it back into the right, into the here and now, you know. I'm just so glad to have this room, you know, that I can sit with other people who are in recovery. I'm quite a suspicious person by nature. I don't believe what is told me. I'm one of these people who has to, you know, put my hand in the fireplace and get burnt to, you know, to know the truth. There's four people in this meeting tonight that I can see in front of me who I know are 15 years clean, because I've been sat with them, watching them, waiting for them to fail, to go out and do something, and they haven't. They are members of Narcotics Anonymous just like I am. You know, I have evidence that I have seen, you know, that this stuff works, you know, it really does work. You know, it's really possible to live a life without drugs. That's I don't know, it's beyond my understanding at times. I want to share about my experience, Strength and Hope. And I guess, my experience is to stay clean. I have stuck going to NA meetings, and that has been my basic thing. Is I go to meetings. You know, every week I go to meetings. You know, I don't think about going to meetings. It's like breathing. You know, and I just go to meetings. You know, and I don't like every meeting I go to. But I like going to the meeting, whether I like being there or not. And what I've learned is it doesn't matter whether I like going to the meeting or not. That's not the point. The point is just go, you know. And I've recently looked up, and I'll go to a meeting because this is a 12-step fellowship. I looked up STEP in the dictionary today. And STEP says a movement of the foot. Which is kind of I've never heard that before, you know. I just thought and to me, that's what it is. It's an action, you know. It's not a 12 step in my head, you know. It's an action thing. It's a movement of the foot. I have to, you know, I can't sit in my house just watching TV thinking about going to me, and I have to move my feet. You know, and there's someone else I know who talked about smart feet. I'm not sure if I can go down smart feet. It's a bit too trendy for me, you know. But I mean, I because I disagree a lot with other addicts as well, and that's really okay. That's really that's something I've really learned. It's really okay to not think the same as other people do in these rooms. You know, I think I was terrified for the first couple of years being in Narcotics Anonymous that I would lose my own identity, you know, that I would become a clone, a robot, a missionary or something, or a zealot or something. And it really hasn't happened, you know, and it's so joyful to know that. You know, because it means I can hold on to my identity, you know, and it means I can be true to myself, you know, because I'm really searching, you know, to find out who I am. What am I doing on this planet? You know, I mean, I've I've come to believe that I have a right to be here. You know, I have a right to exist. You know, I just have a right, you know, to exist and to breathe, same as every other human being does on the earth. You know, I mean, it's a big old concept, you know, and I just feel very blessed, you know, walking across Trafalgar Square tonight and watching all the people from all over the world, you know, who've come here, and my own history of walking through the square. Tonight, I'm on my way to a meeting. I'm on my way to sit with 70 or 100 people who think like I do. You know, that is miraculous for me. I'd like to... I do feel I have some strength in my life now, you know, and a lot of the strength I have is because I had listened to other addicts. You know, I at some stage quite early on, I realised that I didn't have the answers. I also realised that a lot of other people didn't have the answers, you know, a lot of other addicts. So really don't know what they're talking about at all, you know. Well, we are quite crazy at times, you know, individually, but what I learned was collectively, you know, and when we're all doing something in the name of Narcotics Anonymous, all the personal madness seems to go out the window, you know, and we have a kind of collective power or a collective wisdom, so I've always followed the collective wisdom of Narcotics Anonymous rather than the individual wisdoms of Narcotics Anonymous, because on any given day I'm not very well. So please don't listen to me. Listen to us. And you know, that's been my experience, you know. And part of very earlier on when I got in the rooms, after getting over the misery of not using drugs, because I think there's a certain degree, it was for me, you know, the thought of never having a drug again was like leaving a lover. You know, it really was depressing, the thought, I'm never going to have another turn on, I'm never going to get out of my head again, not one, ever. Leave me out, I don't want that. I want to get well, I want to be, you know, I want to be in recovery, but... Oh, I'm not sure about, you know, I'm not sure if I can do that. I'm still not sure whether I can do that, you know. Today I don't have to worry, though. You know, all I have to worry about today is I don't use today. You know, tomorrow, it doesn't matter. You know, I'm still, maybe I'll feel like using tomorrow. Hopefully, I will feel strong enough by what I do today to not use tomorrow. You know, and hopefully tomorrow I'll wake up and I'll remember, you're an addict. No, can't do it today either. You'll have to wait till tomorrow. Thank you for that one. You know, after being in Narcotics for a year or so, some space like a year, I found out that this was a spiritual program and it's a 12-step program. They're a bit entangled, I'm not sure whether I've said that right. It is a spiritual program based on 12 steps. I was quite astounded to find out that these 12 steps are written down, and there is a book. It's an instruction manual. It's called The Basic Text. You know, and I was quite shocked that we wrote this book. I thought it had been written by someone. You know, like, I thought it's a book. You know, we don't write books, we use drugs, you know, we create chaos, you know, we don't sit down and write books. But I just believed that it was written by us, you know, because I believed the people who were in the meetings, I asked them, well, how did this book get written? And they went, oh, well, it was written. I know somebody who was on the committee that wrote it, that put the paragraphs together. And there was big discussions about what to put in, what to leave out. Because 15 years ago, there was still people who around who hadn't died, who were just, you know, responsible for putting some of them stories in the book and stuff like that. So, you know, there was history, there was evidence that it was, you know, it was this really was written by us, you know, this stuff, you know, and also, you know, the 12 steps that we borrowed from someone else because they work for all them alcoholics. Why not work for us, you know? And because I was fed up of having us in their meetings. They just said, you lot, you're all mad, go and start your own fellowship, you know? I mean, great respect for AA. Please, you know, treat that as very respectful in my own way of saying it. I found out that that part of my journey was this is not I can't do someone else's recovery. It was great reading the literature, sitting in meetings, listening to people sharing was great, you know, but I came to the point where I realised that I need to work these steps for myself in my own life. You know, I can't just pounce other people's experience. I have to have a go myself, you know. And it brought up all forces. What is this? It's like sitting an exam at school. I don't want a GCE in the steps, you know. I don't want an MVQ in work in the steps. Can't I just know them without doing anything? You know, because I've heard all about them, you know, I've had these wonderful speakers, you know, that's what it's about, you know. Why do I have to make the effort? Well, I'm the addict, you know. I kind of realise that I'm responsible for my own recovery. You know, however much I can sit in a meeting and I don't know, just sort of it rubs off on me or something. It really don't. I have to do some work, you know. I have to do that movement of the foot stuff. And to do that, to do those steps, I had to get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor, and my first sponsor was a nightmare. And he was a friend. And my own experience is it's not good to have a friend as your sponsor, because your friend will stab you in the back and do all sorts of strange stuff because he's another addict. You know, it was really good for me to find someone who I heard speaking about the steps, and I knew that I respected that individual, but I did not know them, and that was quite important for me because part of the journey was I needed to, you know, follow their guidance. It's a bit like when you're at school, you know, I mean, I don't think I'd respect my teacher if I was smoking behind the bike sheds with them. You know, I'd have just thought, you're just one of us, you know. So it had to be someone who was a teacher. You know, that was my experience of finding a sponsor. But I also wanted to find someone who was in the rooms as well. But so I looked around and I found someone who became my beautiful guy called Terry. And Terry took me through the steps. You know, I went around his house and we'd do some reading and I'd do some writing and then we'd do some more reading. And when I came to step 4 and step 5, I told this guy all my secrets, all my odd little things that happened to me throughout my life, all those strange desires and those terrible things that I'd done and had been done to me. And a lot of those things I have never shared in the meeting, and I have no intention of sharing in a meeting ever. They are not for your ears. You know, they are, but I have shared them with another human being, and when I'd worked the steps, I guess I was faced with, right, you've worked the steps, what happens now? And step 12 is having a spiritual awakening. We try to carry this message to others and practice these principles in all our affairs. I guess my first thought was, well, where's the spiritual awakening? You know, I don't know, spiritual awakening. I mean, when I was a kid, spiritual awakening was St. Paul. He was a tax collector, a Roman tax collector, and he was on the road to Damascus, and something happened. There was a bush started burning, and God came down and changed his mind, and he was changed from that moment. And I thought, well, I haven't had one of them. You know, what is a spiritual awakening? And all I could think about was in my early recovery, after I'd been clean for about 6 months, I was going through a stage where I'd go into a meeting and I'd listen to the chair, but I couldn't stand anyone in the room, so I'd leave the meeting after the chair and go. I wanted to go to the meeting, but I was really feeling really rebellious. I just thought, I hate these people, because I wanted to be clean, but I didn't want to have to do this stuff, you know, this... I don't know what it was. I just went through a stage where I didn't like anybody in NA. I just thought, you're all freaks, you haven't used like I have, you know, I don't like any of you, you don't talk to me, you know, you all dress differently, blah, blah. It was just, I noticed all the differences. I didn't see any of the similarities. I just felt, I hate all of you, you know, and it was raining after this meeting, and I remember being somewhere after this meeting, and I just started crying, and it was raining, and I was stood under some scaffolding, and I just felt so alone. I'm 6 months clean, in recovery, whatever. I just felt really alone, and I don't know whether I heard a voice, but I just had the sensation of a voice saying, "What about me then?" And I can recall, you know, looking around, thinking, "Who said that?" And it just felt like a voice from God just saying, what about me then? You are not alone. You are never alone. You know, you have a higher power. You know, you have a God in your life, whether you like it or not. I've always been here, mate. You know, you've just never noticed me. I am with you, always. And I just felt alright. You know, I just felt all right. And I'd forgotten that. You know, I forgot that moment. But, you know, while I was doing my step 12, I kind of remembered it and thought, is that it? Yeah, I suppose I had that. But I just thought it was a bit like, I think it was probably an acid flashback or something. You know, I don't know, maybe it was some coffee I'd drunk, or maybe I was just hallucinating because I hadn't eaten that day or something. You know, I had a rational explanation for it. And throughout my recovery, I've not actually looked. I've just carried on doing those basic things, going to meetings, and I'm putting up with it. Putting up with it. That sounds dreadful, doesn't it? I suppose I've persevered with it. That's all, because I know that I love being clean. You know, I really appreciate it, and. And another part of my recovery has been doing service and, you know, giving back and taking part in all this stuff. You know, putting my hand up and doing things, you know, to help NA survive and function. And I'll just end with what happened last week to me. I don't know if it was last week or this week. No, it's this week. I'm on a convention committee. I'm part of this London Convention Committee. And part of the reason I do that is because I love being in a convention. And a few years ago, I was in a London convention and I was asked to do a clean time countdown. And it was just one of the most fantastic experiences of my whole life, just to have the microphone and dance around in front of, you know, 1,000 addicts and just... I don't know, just moved the room. It was just awesome, you know. I don't know where that power came to do that stuff, but I really enjoyed it. And part of putting on the convention for me is just, I know that next year in April, I'm going to be stood in that hall in London, up in Euston, and just have that little feeling, I'll put this on. I made this happen. Not just me, you know, there's 20 other people as well, but that feeling of just doing stuff for other people, you know, without a reward, just to just to know that there's people who've just walked through the door are going to, you know, feel that love and stuff like that, it blows me away. Anyway, just back to the spiritual awakening before I end. I had to get some flyers, and there's a committee, somebody had the flyers over in Clark and Well. I was also going to meet someone who was doing the minutes, and they were over in Notting Hill, and it was raining. I think there was a tube strike on or something. I'm stuck in a traffic jam, and I'm not feeling good. I've slept too much, you know, just one of those days. Oh, do I have to do this? But I know, yeah, you've got to do it, Jim. Just do it. This is like breathing for me. I was in the Clerkenwell Road. I turned around, looked out the window. There's a rainbow. Now, I don't know why, but the whole world stopped. You know, my universe stopped. I had to turn the radio off. I was just stuck in a traffic jam, looking out the window at this beautiful rainbow. It was huge. You know, it was a monster. You know, like one of those real colourful blue sky, rainbow, you know, just... and I had a real feeling that there's something wonderful out there. You know, there's something magic in this world. You know, I'm just so glad that I could see that rainbow. You know, I just felt, I'm just so glad I'm alive to see that. Now, if I wasn't doing service, I wouldn't have seen it. If I'm not a member of Narcotics Anonymous, I would have been dead. You know, and I shared with a friend of mine that I'd saw this rainbow. And he said to me, did you know, Jim, that in prehistoric times, man could not see colours because their eyes were not tuned to see in colours. All they saw was black and white and grey, because that's how, you know, our eyes weren't developed that much. So, what a miraculous thing that I can see the colours in my life today. You know, in this room I can see all the colours of all the people. You know, I can see people smiling and just looking confused and looking enthralled or whatever, you know, but I can see that richness. You know, when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, everything was grey, everything was black and white. I could not see those colours. You know, and, you know, my message is that, my experience has been that, you know, my world has become colourful by sticking around, you know, and I intend to stick around, and I would love it if you stayed with me on this journey. Thank you.